This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Welcome to Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio for Wednesday, April 24th, 2024. President Joe Biden signs into law a $95 billion foreign aid bill providing money for Ukraine, Israel, Palestinians, and Taiwan after the Senate passed it late Tuesday night. The president said it's a good day for America, it's a good day for Europe, and it's a good day for world peace. Foreign aid bill also includes a requirement that the Chinese parent company of the TikTok video app sell it or have the app banned in the U.S. We'll talk about what happens next with Shira Ovideh, author of Washington Post's Tech Friend newsletter. House Speaker Mike Johnson travels to Columbia University in New York City, site of the recent pro-Palestinian protests, to call on the school's president to resign, saying she has been shown to be a very weak, inept leader and cannot even guarantee the safety of Jewish students. Supreme Court hears oral argument in a case asking whether an Idaho law that bans abortion except to save the woman's life must yield to a federal law requiring hospitals that receive federal money to provide emergency care to any patient whose life or health is in jeopardy, and whether that means potentially abortion. Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg outlines new rules that will require automatic cash refunds if an airline flight is canceled or seriously delayed. And Congressman Donald Payne Jr., Democrat from New Jersey, has died. He had been in the hospital for a few weeks after a heart attack related to an underlying medical condition. He was 65 years old. Story from CNN. President Joe Biden on Wednesday signed into law an aid package providing crucial military assistance to Ukraine, capping months of negotiations and debate. The aid package, passed by the Senate late Tuesday evening and worth $95 billion in total, includes nearly $61 billion in aid to Ukraine, $26 billion for Israel, and $8 billion for the Indo-Pacific. The package also includes a bill that could eventually lead to the banning of TikTok in the United States, giving Chinese parent company ByteDance roughly 9 months to sell it, or else it will be banned from app stores in the U.S. That was from CNN. President Biden spoke about it at the White House.
This package is literally an investment, not only in Ukraine's security, but in Europe's security, in our own security. We're sending Ukraine equipment from our own stockpiles. Then we'll replenish those stockpiles with new products made by American companies here in America. Patriot missiles made in Arizona, Javelins made in Alabama, artillery shells made in Ohio, Pennsylvania, and Texas. In other words, we're helping Ukraine while at the same time investing in our own industrial base, strengthening our own national security, and supporting jobs in nearly 40 states all across America. You know, the United States is not acting alone, to state the obvious. Our allies in Europe and around the world who have constantly been asking me, are we going to step up? We're not going to walk away, are we? How many, and some of you have been to these international meetings with me. They're very concerned. Had we failed to step up, Lord only knows what would happen to the cohesion in NATO. They're also sending significant help to Ukraine. We're all standing together against this brutal dictator. As I've argued for months, this is directly in the United States' national security interest. If Putin triumphs in Ukraine, the next move of Russian forces could very well be a direct attack on a NATO ally. And you all know full well that invoking Article 5, the North Atlantic Treaty, would be the first thing that comes to mind, which declares an attack on one as an attack on all. If Putin attacks a NATO ally like he's attacking Ukraine today, we'd have no choice but to come to their aid, just like our NATO allies came to our aid after the September 11th attacks. That's why we're supporting and surging support now to Ukraine to stop Putin from drawing the United States into war in Europe and in the future. You know, it seems to me we should take a little bit of a step back and realize what a critical moment this was for the United States and for NATO. This is a historical moment. In the last 2 years, we've helped unify, strengthen, and expand NATO. Imagine if instead we had failed to step up now and support Ukraine. All those gains would have begun to unravel. The cohesion of NATO would have been weakened, and our national security would have been undermined without any question. You know, Putin started this war, believing he could easily break the will of the people of Ukraine. When that failed, he changed his strategy a little bit, thinking we could break the will of NATO, break the will of the United States, break our will. Well, he's failed again.
President Joe Biden at the White House after signing the $95 billion bill, money for Ukraine, Israel, and Taiwan, and other Indo-Pacific allies, and humanitarian aid, including for Palestinians in Gaza. The Senate passed the foreign aid bill Tuesday night, 79-18. Most Senate Republicans voted yes. 15 Senate Republicans voted no. Barrasso, Blackburn, Braun, Budd, Cruz, Hagerty, Hawley, Johnson, Lee, Lummis, Marshall, Rubio, Schmidt, Scott of Florida, and Vance. Also voting no, two Democrats, Merkley and Welch, and one independent, Sanders. Senator J.D. Vance, Republican from Ohio, spoke on the Senate floor on Tuesday against providing more money to Ukraine. He said comparisons to World War II were inaccurate.
Vladimir Putin is not Adolf Hitler. Doesn't mean he's a good guy, but he has significantly less capability than the German leader did in the late 1930s. America is not America of the late 1930s or the early 1940s. We are substantially, we possess substantially less manufacturing might in relative terms than we did almost 100 years ago. And most importantly, there are many ways in which the analogy falls apart, even if you ignore America's capacity, Russia's capacity, and the like. There are ways in which we should be looking at other historical analogies, and I'd like to point just a couple of those right now. The Second World War, of course, was the most devastating war, arguably, in the history of the world. Close behind it is the First World War. And what is the lesson of the First World War? It's not that there are always people appeasing the bad guys or fighting against the bad guys. The lesson of World War I is that if you're not careful, you can blunder yourself into a broader regional conflict that kills tens of millions of people, many of them innocent. In 1914, alliances, politics, and the failure of statesmanship dragged two rival blocks of militaries into a catastrophic conflict. In the past week alone, the Council on Foreign Relations has published an essay calling for European troops to sustain Ukraine's lines as Ukraine struggles to raise troops. Some European leaders have said they might send troops to support Ukraine in a conflict. Perhaps the history lesson we should be teaching ourselves isn't Chamberlain versus Churchill. Perhaps we should be asking ourselves how an entire continent, how an entire world's set of leaders allowed itself to blunder into world conflict. Is there possibly a diplomatic solution to the conflict in Ukraine? Yes, I believe that there is. Indeed, as multiple people, both critics of Vladimir Putin and supporters of Ukraine, have pointed out, there was, in fact, a peace deal on the table approximately 18 months ago, and what happened to it? The Biden administration pushed Zelensky to set aside the peace agreement and to engage in a disastrous counteroffensive, a counteroffensive that killed thousands, tens of thousands of Ukrainians, that depleted an entire decade's worth of military stocks, and has left us in the place that we are now, where every single objective observer of the Ukraine war acknowledges today that the war is going worse for Ukraine than it was 18 months ago.
Senator J.D. Vance, Republican from Ohio, on the Senate floor on Tuesday, before the Senate passed the $95 billion foreign aid bill for Ukraine, Israel, and Taiwan, joining the House that had passed it last weekend, and President Biden signed it into law today. Pentagon putting out a statement following the passage of the National Security Supplemental, which the president just signed into law, the Department of Defense announced a significant new security assistance to urgently meet Ukraine's critical security and defense needs. This announcement is the Biden administration's 56th tranche of equipment to be provided from DoD inventories to Ukraine since August 2021. The Presidential Drawdown Authority package has an estimated value of $1 billion and includes capabilities to support Ukraine's most urgent requirements, including air defense interceptors, artillery rounds, armored vehicles, and anti-tank weapons. That was the statement from the Department of Defense. An article at RT.com, a Russian government-funded news site, has this paragraph: the Kremlin has repeatedly warned that Washington's lethal aid will not change the situation on the battlefield in Ukraine's favor. According to Kremlin spokesperson Dmitry Peskov, the U.S. government has effectively been funneling billions of dollars into its own military-industrial complex through the aid scheme. Also in the new foreign aid bill, now law, a requirement that the Chinese company ByteDance sell its short video app TikTok or face a ban from U.S. app stores. TikTok is used by 170 million Americans. U.S. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan asked today at the White House news conference about this.
This bill gives ByteDance 270 days to sell TikTok due to those national security concerns, which could lead to a national ban. In the meantime, is it safe for President Biden's campaign and any other political entity to be on TikTok?
So I'm going to let campaigns decide for themselves what they're going to do. The terms of the bill are straightforward. TikTok continues to operate as it is right now until such time as either there is divestment or the time that you referred to elapses. And so what we're focused on right now in implementing the bill is working through that divestment in a way that is consistent with the intent of the law and consistent with the national security concerns that brought the law into force in the first place.
Tech Friend newsletter at the Washington Post has an article with the headline, "Everything TikTok Users Need to Know About a Possible Ban." Author Shira Ovide joins us now. Thank you for being with us. So this bill is now law. What happens and how fast?
Well, nothing is going to happen immediately. I think that's the most important message for people to know. TikTok has already said that it's going to challenge the brand new law in court. And so the law, as it's written, gives essentially 9 months to a year for TikTok to find a new non-Chinese owner or face a possible ban in the United States. But the litigation that's now going to start from TikTok's end could delay that timeline even longer. So nothing's changing with the TikTok app on people's phones for now.
How strong might the challenge be?
Well, look, any legal case is kind of a wild card, and it's going to be difficult to predict the outcome one way or the other. But when we've spoken to kind of constitutional law experts, one of the things they point out is, you know, TikTok has a case here by sort of saying that the government might be overstepping the Constitution with this law by targeting a single company that it dislikes. And also Americans or people in the United States have a First Amendment right to use apps like TikTok for free expression. So any legal challenge that TikTok is going to start now, it has to overcome those kind of constitutional hurdles. And, you know, that bar is pretty high. And in the past, when there have been these kinds of legal challenges to TikTok, generally courts have sort of said, wait, I think the law or any kind of ban is going too far in infringing on Americans' constitutional rights.
And sticking with the legal aspect of this, if a ban were to be imposed, how would it be enforced? And would the owners of the app stores have a case?
Yeah, it's a great point. So the way that this, again, there's a lot of things we don't know about the mechanics of a ban and how it would exactly work if we get that far. But the way it's been proposed is that the owners of the dominant app stores in the United States, so that's Apple for iPhones and Google for Android phones, they would basically be prohibited under law from letting anyone download TikTok onto smartphones in the United States. And there's questions about, okay, well, if you already have TikTok on your phone, would they have the power to kind of pull that back? And I think the answer to that is we don't know, probably not, but we're not sure yet. And in terms of whether Apple or Google might say, no, we don't want to do this, again, we don't know the answer to what Apple and Google might do if they would contest this. But generally, these companies say they have to comply with laws of the countries in which they operate, and that includes the United States. And so if this is a valid law in the United States, it's odds are that Apple and Google will go along with the law.
We're talking with Shira Ovideh from The Washington Post, turning to the business aspect of it, and I appreciate this. There's a lot of speculation here, but you have a subhead, could TikTok find a new owner in time? So let's say that they say, yes, we're going to sell. Could it actually happen?
I will say the same thing I keep saying, which is we don't know yet. But you're right. The law as it's written is not a straight up ban. It's essentially an ultimatum to ByteDance, which is the Chinese company that owns TikTok. So either TikTok needs to find a new owner, at least in the United States, to replace ByteDance, or the app is going to be banned in the United States within this kind of year or so time frame. The odds of finding a buyer, it's going to be really difficult. So first of all, we don't yet know how the Chinese government might respond to this new law in the United States. The Chinese government has said in the past that it opposes a forced sale of TikTok, which is more or less what this new law is. If someone were to buy TikTok, either just the operations in the United States or TikTok's global operations in many countries, that would be at least tens of billions of dollars, if not a couple hundred billion dollars. And most people and most companies do not have that kind of money. And the companies that do have lots of money that could, in theory, buy TikTok, companies like Google or Meta, which owns Facebook, they probably couldn't buy TikTok because antitrust regulators wouldn't allow that in the United States or in other countries. So that's probably a no-go. And, you know, there's also these other questions, just technical questions about, can you really separate sort of TikTok just in the United States from the TikTok that operates elsewhere in the world? Can you separate TikTok from the algorithm that controls TikTok that is basically, you know, largely overseen by the Chinese parent company, ByteDance? So there's all these open questions, but it does seem like finding a new owner is difficult.
And finally, you're a tech column, and you address what users and creators might be considering now about what could happen in the future with TikTok.
Yeah, I get it. Look, I think it's probably time for people who use TikTok either just, you know, to look at videos, or people who make a living on TikTok, to start to think about a plan B. And that could mean, if you're, you know, somebody who uses the app, scrolls the app, if you have, you know, favorite accounts or favorite creators on TikTok, it might be worth looking to see if they post on YouTube or on Instagram and following them there. Again, if you make a living on TikTok through your videos or through selling merchandise on TikTok, it's probably not a bad idea to be thinking about, well, should I establish a presence on Instagram, on Facebook, on Snapchat, on somewhere else that doesn't have this risk of this app being banned in a year or so? If you post on TikTok, it might not be a bad idea to sort of go to your account and download the data that you have there, download the videos and other data that you have there. Again, nothing is going to happen immediately. No one is going to wake up tomorrow or in 6 months and this app will just be gone, disappear without warning in the United States. But again, it's probably not a bad idea at this point to start thinking about what you might do if TikTok does basically get kicked out of the United States sometime in the next year or so.
Shira Ovideh is the author of Tech Friend newsletter at The Washington Post. You can find it at washingtonpost.com. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
And as for why the TikTok ban was included in the foreign aid bill that was signed into law today, this paragraph from a CBS News article, U.S. officials have repeatedly warned that TikTok threatens national security because the Chinese government could use it to spy on Americans or weaponize it to covertly influence the U.S. public by amplifying or suppressing certain content. This is Washington Today. And from ABC News, protests on college campuses calling for the divestment of funds from Israeli military operations continue to spread on Wednesday, even as hundreds of students have been arrested. The student protests, some of which have turned into around-the-clock encampments, have erupted throughout the nation following arrests and student removals at Columbia University. Schools including Yale University, New York University, Harvard University, Massachusetts Institute of Technology, Tufts University, and more have launched protests. That was reporting from ABC News. U.S. House Speaker Mike Johnson, Republican from Louisiana, and several other House Republicans visited Columbia University today in New York City. They included New York's Mike Lawler, Anthony D'Esposito, and Nicole Malliotakis, and also Congresswoman Virginia Fox of North Carolina. She chairs the Education and Workforce Committee. They met with Jewish students and called on the university president to resign. Here's Speaker Mike Johnson.
We just left a meeting with students, Jewish students, who told us of the heinous acts of bigotry that they have experienced simply because of their faith. Their bravery is inspiring, much more inspiring than some of the activities we're seeing here. And they should never have to confront such hate on an American college campus. It's such a revered institution. Anti-Semitism has been growing in America, and it's clear why. Powerful people have refused to condemn it, and some have even peddled it themselves. From university professors to public officials, people in positions of authority have denied the horrific facts of September 11, 2001, the attacks on the United States that happened right here in New York City, and they've attempted to excuse or to ignore the barbaric attack of Hamas in Israel on October 7, 2023, where Israeli women and children were savagely raped and murdered, and infants were cooked in ovens. Crowds of radical activists have chanted death to America and on our own streets in this country, and sub-public officials have refused to condemn them. Others have openly defended these acts on campus, and the harassing and the intimidation and the threatening of innocent Jewish students simply because of who they are. They've called that peaceful protest, and some have even gone as far as calling for the state of Israel to be eliminated. These are words we expect from Ayatollahs in Iran, not American lawmakers and not American students. And unsurprisingly, it has given way to threats and violence in a generation of students who feel safe in their own classrooms, who don't feel safe in their own classrooms, or where they live or where they worship. Let me say this very simply. No American of any color or creed should ever have to live under those kinds of threats. That is not who we are in this country. Sadly, Columbia's administrators have chosen to let the threats, the fear, and the intimidation of the mob rule to overtake American principles like free speech and the free exchange of ideas and the free exercise of religion. They have co-opted First Amendment arguments to protect genocide and to elevate the voices of anti-Semitism. They have proven themselves to be incapable of achieving their basic responsibility, which is keeping students safe. We just can't allow this kind of hatred and anti-Semitism to flourish on our campuses, and it must be stopped in its tracks. Those who are perpetrating this violence should be arrested. And I'm here today joining my colleagues and calling on President Shafiq to resign if she cannot immediately bring order to this chaos. As Speaker of the House, I am committing today that the Congress will not be silent as Jewish students are expected to run for their lives and stay home from their classes hiding in fear. In the House of Representatives, we've already acted to address anti-Semitism on campuses. We have passed a number of statutes to address this matter, and we call upon the U.S. Senate to act upon our legislation.
U.S. House Speaker Mike Johnson, Republican from Louisiana, at Columbia University in New York City, a news conference with a handful of other House Republicans. New York Governor Kathy Hochul, a Democrat, was asked at a news conference in Albany about Speaker Johnson's visit and the demand that the Columbia University president resign.
Governor, you met on Monday with Columbia President Manu Shafiq. Are you satisfied with her leadership? And how do you feel about the Speaker of the House being there today on campus and calling for her resignation?
It seems to me there's a lot more responsibilities and crises to be dealt with in Washington. I'd encourage the Speaker to go back and perhaps take up the the migrant bill, the bill to deal with closing the borders so we can deal with a real crisis that New York has. So I think politicizing this and, you know, bringing the entourage to put a spotlight on this is only adding to the division. And a speaker worth the title should really be trying to heal people and not divide them. So I don't think it adds to anything. I went there privately. I did not bring press with me. I wanted to have a substantive conversation about public safety with the president, with campus security, with the NYPD. And at the time, they just made the decision to go remote, to dial down the pressure for the students, and also to, you know, literally provide escorts for every student who wants one, provide more visible campus security, and when they feel necessary, you know, bring in extreme circumstances, you know, NYPD has been there and very well trained in how to manage these circumstances. So that was the approach that she laid out, but I also know that she wanted to do something else, and that was to begin a line of communication with the protesters. Find out what they need, what they're asking for, and is there a way to diffuse the situation? And that's what we're starting to see. I'm understanding that some of the encampments are coming down. So that's what we need, is, you know, respecting honest debate and the right to protest. But when it veers into the hateful, vile speech that has been directed at Jewish students, compromising their sense of security that they deserve to have, something that's critically important, that's what I'm hearing from the students I met. So that was Monday. It is still playing out in terms of their negotiations. So time will tell, but that's my assessment from my meeting there.
Are you satisfied with your leadership?
I want to make sure that we get the results we need, which is make sure that every student on campus, every student feels safe and secure. And I believe that is the path that they're attempting to be on.
New York Governor Kathy Hochul, a Democrat. News conference in New York City. Story from the Texas Tribune. Law enforcement officers on Wednesday handcuffed and removed at least 10 people participating in a student protest on the University of Texas at Austin campus in support of Palestine amid the Israeli-Hamas war. UT Austin students demanding that the university divest from manufacturers supplying Israel weapons in its strikes on Gaza gathered outside the university's Gregory Gym with plans to march to the South Lawn, where they said they would sit down throughout the day. More than 200 students had gathered as of noon. Authorities detained the protesters after telling students they could face criminal trespass charges if they didn't disperse. A story from the Texas Tribune, one of many protests at campuses happening around the country. Today is Armenian Genocide Remembrance Day, acknowledging the deaths of 1.5 million Armenians at the hands of the Ottomans in 1915 by massacre and starvation. This video was posted by a member of Congress.
Hi, I'm Congressman David Balladale. As the co-chair of the Congressional Caucus on Armenian Issues, I'm honored to work on behalf of the Armenian Americans in Congress and bring awareness to the concerns their communities face. Today marks the anniversary of the start of the Armenian Genocide. 108 years ago, the Ottoman Empire began a systematic extermination of the Armenian people. In just 8 years, more than 1.5 million Armenians were murdered or displaced, a tragedy that is still deeply felt today. I know the pain of these atrocities are still felt by many Armenian Americans. We will never forget the men, women, and children whose lives were lost or forever changed by this tragedy. At a time when the Armenian people of Artsakh are under attack by Azerbaijan, it is more important than ever that the United States stand firmly with the Armenian community to ensure a tragedy like this never happens again. I will continue to be a strong voice for the Armenian community in Congress.
Congressman David Balladeo, Republican from California, posting that video. President Biden with a statement that begins, "Today we pause to remember the lives lost during the Medyegern, the Armenian genocide, and renew our pledge to never forget." Today there are about 500,000 Armenian Americans. More than half live in California. Washington Today continues in a moment.
Hi there. I'm Jonathan from C-SPAN, along with my colleague, Ben. Since C-SPAN's founding 45 years ago, the media world has changed. Remember when there were just a few TV channels? Now we've got streaming, social media, apps, and more.
Through all of this, C-SPAN has stayed true to its mission of giving you unfiltered access to government wherever you get your news. As we navigate this challenging media environment with fewer people subscribing to traditional cable packages, our funding has been impacted.
That's why we're asking for your help. to keep going strong for another 45 years. Please donate today at cspan.org/donate. Your contribution, large or small, helps ensure at least another 45 years of witnessing democracy in action.
Keep C-SPAN thriving in today's ever-changing media landscape. Visit cspan.org/donate to make your gift today. Thank you.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Welcome back to Washington Today, available as a podcast wherever you find your podcasts and on the free C-SPAN Now mobile app. From AP, conservative Supreme Court justices appeared skeptical Wednesday that state abortion bans taking effect after their sweeping ruling overturning Roe v. Wade violate federal health care law, though some also questioned the effects on emergency pregnancy care. The case marks the first time the Supreme Court has considered the implications of a state ban since overturning the nationwide right to abortion. It comes from Idaho, which is among 14 states that now ban abortion at all stages of pregnancy with very limited exceptions. The Justice Department says abortion care must be allowed under a law that requires hospitals accepting Medicare to provide emergency care regardless of patients' ability to pay. From AP. Here's some of the oral argument in the consolidated case, Moyle v. United States, Justice Samuel Alito questioning U.S. Solicitor General Elizabeth Prelogar.
I don't understand how your argument about preemption here squares with the theory of spending clause, of Congress's spending clause power. The theory is Congress can tell a state or any other entity or person, look, here's some money or other thing of value, and if you want to accept it, fine, then you have to accept certain conditions. But how does the Congress's ability to do that authorize it to impose duties on another party that has not agreed to accept this money?
There are no duties being imposed on Idaho here. It's not required to provide emergency stabilizing treatment itself. The duties are
well, all right,
to the
not duties. How can you impose restrictions on what Idaho can criminalize simply because hospitals in Idaho have chosen to participate in Medicare? I don't understand how this squares with the whole theory of the spending clause.
Well, I think that it squares with this court's long line of precedents cited at page 46 of
I've looked at those cases. I haven't found any square discussion of this particular issue. But I'm interested in the theory. Can you just explain how it works in theory?
Sure. So spending clause legislation is federal law. It's passed by both houses of Congress. It's signed by the president. It qualifies as law within the meaning of the supremacy clause.
Absolutely.
And so I think the Supremacy Clause dictates the relevant principle here, in a situation where Congress has enacted law, it has full force and effect under the Supremacy Clause, and what a state can't do is interpose its own law as a direct obstacle to being able to fulfill the federal funding conditions. And this theory, Justice Alito, would mean no conditions under Medicare are enforceable.
They're absolutely enforceable against the hospital that chooses to participate.
Supreme Court Justice Samuel Alito questioning U.S. Solicitor General Elizabeth Prelogar in today's case, Moyle v. United States, challenging the Idaho law that restricts abortion. An NPR article explains in 1986, Congress passed the Emergency Medical Treatment and Labor Act, or EMTALA. The law provides that hospitals receiving Medicare and Medicaid payments from the federal government, and that is most hospitals, must provide stabilizing care for any patient whose life or health is in serious jeopardy. The hospital can't provide the care, it is required to provide safe transport to another hospital that can. That was all well and good until the Supreme Court's 2022 Dobbs decision, which struck down Roe v. Wade and returned the abortion question to the states. Since then, a handful of states have adopted laws that make it illegal to provide standard emergency treatment that includes terminating a pregnancy if the woman's health, but not her life, is in imminent danger. That explanation from an NPR article. Back to the oral argument, Justice Alito questioning Solicitor General Elizabeth Prelogar, pointing to a specific phrase in that law.
We've now heard, an hour and a half of argument on this case. And one potentially very important phrase in EMTALA has hardly been mentioned. Maybe it hasn't even been mentioned at all. And that is EMTALA's reference to the woman's quote-unquote unborn child. Isn't that an odd phrase to put in a statute that imposes a mandate to perform abortions? Have you ever seen an abortion statute that uses the phrase unborn child?
It's not an odd phrase when you look at what Congress was doing in 1989. There were well-publicized cases where women were experiencing conditions, their own health and life were not in danger, but the fetus was in grave distress and hospitals weren't treating them.
Well,
so what Congress did is that
it... Have you seen abortion statutes that use the phrase unborn child? Doesn't that tell us something?
It tells us that Congress wanted to expand the protection for pregnant women so that they could get the same duties to screen and stabilize when they have a condition that's threatening the health and well-being of the unborn child. But what it doesn't suggest is that Congress simultaneously displaced the independent pre-existing obligation to treat a woman who herself is facing grave life and health consequences.
U.S. Solicitor General Elizabeth Prelogar questioned by Supreme Court Justice Samuel Alito at today's case. Idaho Constitutional Litigation and Policy Chief Josh Turner argued for the other side. Justice Elena Kagan asked him about abortions when a woman's health, but not life, is in jeopardy.
Do you concede that with respect to certain medical conditions, an abortion is the standard of care?
No, because the standard of care under, well, I should say, in Idaho, there is a life-saving exception for certain abortions. And that is the standard of care. And the standard of care is necessarily set and determined by state.
Well, I think you have to concede that with respect to certain medical conditions, abortion is the standard of care because your own statute, as interpreted by your own courts, acknowledges that when a condition gets bad enough such that the woman's life is in peril, then the doctors are supposed to give abortions. And the reason that that's true is that with respect to certain rare but extremely obviously important conditions and circumstances, abortion is the accepted medical standard of care. Isn't that right?
Yes, and that was my point, that there is a life-saving exception under Idaho law. Now, the question here
the question is it also the accepted standard of care when, rather than the woman's life being in peril, the woman's health is in peril? So let's take, all of these cases are rare, but within these rare cases, there's a significant number where the woman is, her life is not in peril, but she's going to lose her reproductive organs. She's going to lose the ability to have children in the future, unless an abortion takes place. Now, that's the category of cases in which EMTALA says, my gosh, of course the abortion is necessary to assure that no material deterioration occurs. And yet Idaho says, sorry, no abortion here. And the result is that these patients are now helicoptered out of state.
Yeah. Your Honor, the hypothetical you raise is a very difficult situation. And these situations, I mean, nobody's arguing that they don't raise tough medical questions that implicate deeply theological and moral questions. And Idaho, like 22 other states, and even Congress and EMTALA, recognizes that there are two patients to consider in those circumstances. And the two-patient scenario is tough when you have these competing interests.
You know, that would be a good response if federal law did not take a position on what you characterize as a tough question. But federal law does take a position on that question. It says that you don't have to wait until the person is on the verge of death.
Supreme Court Justice Elena Kagan questioning Idaho Constitutional Litigation and Policy Chief Josh Turner during oral argument in the case Moyle v. U.S., argued today. It ran about 2 hours. You can find it in full at our website, cspan.org. On Thursday at 10 a.m. Eastern, the Supreme Court hears the case Trump v. U.S. on the question of whether former President Donald Trump has presidential immunity from prosecution for his alleged role in trying to overturn the 2020 presidential election. He's been charged with that at the federal level and in Georgia. Supreme Court Live Thursday, 10 a.m. Eastern on C-SPAN Radio, C-SPAN Television, streamed at cspan.org, and the C-SPAN Now mobile app. Back to the abortion issue. Today's oral argument before the Supreme Court brought some protesters to the sidewalk in front of that court. And today, Kellyanne Conway, former White House counselor in the Trump administration, was asked about what the abortion issue means in the November elections.
Whether it's 15 weeks, 12 weeks, 10 weeks, 6 weeks, 24 weeks, I just believe these candidates should be forward-facing, tell you what they believe, why they believe that, and stick with it. But this was my criticism in 2022, and it is my warning in 2024 for those not listening and taking what I think is not my advice, but solid advice, is not necessarily my advice, but it is solid advice, which is this. If you are just hiding under your desk, hoping the shrapnel won't hit you, you're not listening to vote. It took 50 years to overturn Roe versus Wade. It's going to take more than hours, or indeed 50 weeks, to explain to people what that means. People were afraid. They were angry. They were frustrated. They were outraged. And some folks ran to the states and did these initiatives. We didn't take a penny from any of them. I thought many of them were poorly handled. I've said that many times. I'll say it again. They were poorly handled because you're not explaining to people what they would do and what they wouldn't do. And if in Kansas, the name of the initiative is, quote, no state constitutional right to an abortion, that's going to be hard to pass. If in Michigan, it's unfairly and deceptively named reproductive freedom for all, that's going to be hard to defeat. So people need to wise up, and I believe you have to understand that, understand where people are, understand where the consensus is. And then Michael, everybody's polling shows there is a consensus when you talk about either no abortion ever, that's a very small percentage of the population, like 8 or 9%, or to save life for the mother, or in cases of rape or incest conceptions. And then if you add the Dobbs fact pattern to that 15 weeks, let's just call it roughly the first trimester, you're up to about 70% of the country.
Kellyanne Conway, former White House counselor in the Trump administration, now a Fox News contributor, interviewed today on the Washington Post Live program. From ABC News, good news for airline travelers. The Department of Transportation on Wednesday is rolling out new rules that will require airlines to automatically give cash refunds to passengers for canceled and significantly delayed flights. The delays covered would be more than 3 hours for domestic flights and more than 6 hours for international flights, the agency said. This includes tickets purchased directly from airlines, travel agents, and third-party sites, such as Expedia and Travelocity. DOT will also require airlines to give cash refunds if your bags are lost and not delivered within 12 hours. Airlines will have 6 months to comply with the new rules. That reporting from ABC News, Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg spoke about it at Ronald Reagan Washington National Airport.
With the first rule that we're announcing today, the Biden-Harris administration is now requiring that if an airline cancels or significantly delays your flight, within 7 days, they will be required to provide an automatic refund to the credit card that you use to book it without you having to call or wait on hold or sort through digital paperwork or haggle with that airline. Importantly, we are also changing the refund to clarify that it must be by cash. It must be in cash by default unless a passenger actively chooses another form of compensation rather than the other way around. No more defaulting to vouchers or credits when consumers may not even realize that they are entitled to cash. We're also putting another rule on the books, protecting airline passengers from being surprised by fees. These charges can really add up for things like a checked bag, a carry-on bag, change fees, cancellation fees. Healthy competition requires that as a consumer, you comparison shop, which means knowing the real price of a trip before and not after you buy. So airlines will now be required to show you these costs up front so you have all the information you need to decide what travel option is best for you. We estimate this will save Americans over $500 million every year. From day one of this administration, we have been working to improve the entire experience for airline passengers, from more transparency when you book your ticket to a better experience when you get to the airport, thanks to the terminal improvements that we're making through the Biden infrastructure package, to the most important part of all, which is safety and peace of mind, secured by better staffing, better technology, better oversight, and better infrastructure. And, of course, knowing that if something does go wrong and your flight is canceled, the U.S. Department of Transportation has your back.
Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg at a news conference at Reagan National Airport. Story at Fortune magazine, Airlines for America, the lobby group for the North American airline industry, said in a statement, the 11 largest U.S. passenger airlines issued $43 billion in customer refunds, $900 million per month, between January 2020 and December 2023, in addition to issuing other forms of compensation. And then in the Fortune magazine article, they write, but currently it's common for airlines to issue a travel credit or voucher by default instead of a cash refund, making it more cumbersome for passengers to rebook another airline. To get a refund, travelers typically have to jump through a series of hoops on the airline's website or app or spend lengthy sessions waiting on the phone. On Wall Street today, the Dow down 42, NASDAQ up 16, S&P up 1. Congressman Donald Payne Jr., writes NorthJersey.com, died Wednesday. Governor Phil Murphy reported he had been hospitalized since suffering a heart attack from diabetes complications on April 6th. A Newark native, Payne was first elected to represent New Jersey's 10th congressional district in Washington in 2012, succeeding his father in that post. He also served on the city council in Newark and a freeholder in Essex County. The 65-year-old congressman was in stable condition under doctor's care, said a statement released by his office on April 17th. The governor said he and First Lady Tammy Murphy are deeply saddened by the tragic passing of our friend and a steadfast champion for the people of New Jersey. That was reporting by NorthJersey.com. Congressman Payne's last House floor speech was March 22nd, in which he supported President Biden's plans for housing.
Mr. Speaker, I rise today to praise President Biden's work to improve housing in America. The president's leadership in this area has led to lower housing costs. It has expanded rental assistance, and it has increased affordable housing nationwide. Now the president wants to implement the most consequential housing plan in 50 years in this country. It would provide a $10,000 tax credit for first-time home buyers and people who sell their starter homes. It would build and renovate more than 2 million homes. The plan would crack down on corporate actions that rob renters. And it would provide rental assistance for hundreds of thousands of families, veterans, and youth leaving foster care. It is a bold plan that would benefit millions of Americans, and I am proud to support it on the House floor today. And with that, Mr. Speaker, I yield back.
Congressman Donald Payne Jr., Democrat from New Jersey, speaking on the House floor in Washington on March 22nd, a few weeks later, he had a heart attack and entered the hospital, and it's just been reported that he has passed away at the age of 65. The House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries, Democrat from New York, posting on X, deeply saddened by the passing of Congressman Donald Payne Jr., a good friend, highly effective public servant, and compassionate leader. My prayers and support are with the Payne family and his loved ones during this difficult time. May he forever rest in peace. Thanks for listening to Washington Today. Subscribe to C-SPAN's free evening newsletter Word for Word, and you'll get the stories making headlines in Washington emailed to you every day. You can sign up at cspan.org/connect. Have a good night.